to show success.
And gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. We have a very special show for you, ladies and gentlemen. We have a guest coming on the phone who used to be part of the Soviet Nuclear Intelligence Services, who's going to give us his groundbreaking report on the possibility of nukes being used in the World Trade Center's, attacks on September 11. So it's going to be all good. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. If you haven't heard this show before, I'm your host, Vinnie Eastwood, and that was my Russian accent, which I apparently can do quite well, according to some sources, but I don't think those sources have any credibility. Anyway, we've got a dynamite show. Oh, no, actually, a nuclear show for you today, ladies and gentlemen. Quite excited about it because this is groundbreaking stuff, really. Now, I'm not 100% sure whether or not I believe or can corroborate all the evidence. I mean, and quite frankly, I believe I don't possess qualifications to make such a claim, even if I did believe it. But I still believe in the other sense that we should kind of listen to absolutely everything, believe nothing until you actually check it out for yourself. And in lieu of being able to check it out for yourself, talk to the experts, which we will be having on the show after this first short segment. And
Firstly,
yep.
Let's kick off the week by saying I disagree with you thoroughly, Vinny. How about that? How's that for a positive outlook on life? No, I mean, I disagree with the contention that people shouldn't believe in anything. I think that's totally and utterly wrong. I think if people are rudderless up a creek, then they're in Crap Creek right now, as we all are. And if you don't know, have any direction in your life and don't believe in anything, then you'll just go with the flow and be washed down the waterfall with everyone else.
Well, you know, I'm talking about belief in the sense of facts and evidence and that kind of thing. I mean, they sort of form your beliefs, but then is it actually a belief if facts and evidence lead you to a conclusion? I'm not sure. But anyway, in other news in New Zealand, we are now going to be treated to some fabulous naked body scanners at Auckland International Airport, and the pretext of which is, oh, these people are so dangerous and they're carrying drugs, so now we need to microwave them all and have fabulous naked pictures of everybody, including the children, because obviously those children must be smuggling ecstasy tablets somewhere.
And this is where belief comes in. We are going to stop this, aren't we, Vinny? We are not going to allow this in New Zealand. We're not going to allow this without a big fight. This is ridiculous. And this is where belief comes in. People got to believe in themselves, they got to believe in principles, and they got to stand up to scum. It's only with belief that you don't waver in the wind.
Yeah, I'm sure the Muslim Brotherhood agrees with you. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. And we'll be right back after the break. back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on American Freedom Radio. Don't know where our guests are at the moment. They seem to be having problems connecting them at present. Probably just something to do with the NSA. But anyway, if you would like to actually preface this conversation we're about to have, and it's going to be a, well, it's going to be quite a big one because we've got a couple of people that will be coming on simultaneously. There will be Dmitry Kalazov and JB Campbell from Veterans Today. And we've also just had another person as well, Raylan Allen, wife of former CIA agent Gunter Rosbauer, who will all be coming on together for a big panel discussion about nuclear devices in the World Trade Center. So we'll let you know when we're able to bring those guys up together. As soon as it is possible, it will happen. Now, if you'd like to preface this and actually do a bit of background study, there's a 26-part presentation, approximately 4 hours long in total, on YouTube entitled Why Use Dynamite When Can Use Atomic Bomb 20 of 26. That's Why Use Dynamite When Can Use Atomic Bomb 20 Well, there's 26 parts there for you. All right, so I've managed to get up to part 20 before the show today, and it's quite a quite an interesting one. So one thing that I've really kind of got to say about 9/11 is that, well, whatever the truth is, it's certainly not whatever the government's telling us, and it's conceivably, in my opinion, never has even been close. not even close at all whatsoever. You know, if the government was telling the truth, they wouldn't have missed out World Trade Center 7 from the 9/11 Commission report. If the government was telling the truth, 6 out of 10 of the 9/11 commissioners wouldn't have come out and said that they were set up to fail. If 9/11 was the truth, we would have not seen the towers come down the way they did, because you cannot melt steel with jet fuel / kerosene fires, particularly when a lot of the floors are surrounded with fireproof asbestos. No steel frame building in the history of the world, before or since 9/11, has ever collapsed due to fire. Okay, those are the facts. And it's unfortunate to see what else is going down here. Now, hold on a second. Do we have somebody on the line there? Is that JB Campbell?
It is.
Hey, Campbell, how you doing, mate?
Real good.
Campbell,
are you there? Is he still with us? Campbell, you still there, mate?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Well, could you just kind of preface for us this conversation that we're about to have, probably continuing on next segment, with Dmitry, because you've been in close contact with him since he came out with this information.
Right. Dmitry Kalazov is a former officer of the Soviet military, and his job was for over 10 years to monitor and investigate nuclear explosions anywhere in the world. And he could describe specifically what unit he was in. It was called the Special Control Service of the 12th Chief Directorate, the Soviet Defense Ministry. But he left the Soviet Union, I think, around 92. You can ask him. But when it became the Russian Federation, he moved to the Far East and eventually to Bangkok, where he lives now. He moved there in the mid-90s. In about 1997, he was approached and befriended by agents of Israel's Mossad there in Bangkok. And they kind of cultivated him and, you know, schmoozed with him, and no doubt due to his military occupation specialty, which gave him great knowledge of nuclear weapons. So then a few years later, in January of 2001, He was introduced by these guys to the infamous Mossad hitman and former advisor to Manuel Noriega, and is involved in a lot of nefarious things over the years. His name was Michael Harari, Mike Harari, and he and as they became more acquainted, this Israeli guy asked Dmitry if the Soviet military was aware of the nuclear demolition plan for the World Trade Center. Dmitry said, yeah, we all knew about it for years. It was well known. And there was a special 1976 treaty between the U.S. and the USSR that allowed, it was a limit of 150 kilotons, devices that were 150 kilotons to be used to demolish, perhaps one day in the future, the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center and the Sears Tower in Chicago. And that was the only way that the New York Port Authority would permit those gigantic Twin Towers to be built. They demanded the demolition plan. The architects, though, they really had no idea how to destroy the things. They were designing them to be virtually indestructible. So they finally got brought in this outfit. You've heard of it, Controlled Demolition Incorporated, the famous demolition firm in Maryland, the Loazzo family, to come up with some kind of a plan. So they came up with this plan using nuclear explosions. And that was acceptable to the New York Port Authority. So really, the nuke demolition plan was there from the start. So these are two important facts that Dmitry is witness to. And the third important fact, the Pentagon attack, is also something about which he can testify in court, and that is that the Pentagon was hit by a Soviet-made cruise missile known as the Granite, like granite without an E on the end, Granite, which was taken from the sunken Soviet submarine, the Kursk.
Allegedly one of 20, was it 21 or 22 missiles that went missing from the Kursk?
I think it was 22, but you can ask him, and he knows. That happened about 13 months earlier in August of 2000. Mm. But he can tell you all about that.
Each of which of these missiles has a half kiloton, or is a half megaton?
Half megaton, 500 kilotons.
So, you know, huge amount of plutonium and incredibly expensive weaponry, not to mention the destructive capability is quite substantial. One of these missiles, for example, detonating over, say, London, depending on how high it was, if it was detonated at ground level, it would destroy about 70% of the city. If it was detonated half a kilometer in the air, it would destroy the entire city. So these are huge, huge stories that haven't really come out to the public as yet. And I'm wondering what the U.S. government is kind of thinking about. When this sort of information is being sent to them by Dmitry, and they do nothing.
Well, they're trying to cover it up. I mean, they've covered it up pretty well, but they've got a patsy now named Victor Boot, and he can tell you about his friend Victor Boot, who's now in New York. He's been extradited out of Thailand and is being blamed kind of secretly for selling this Granite missile to the terrorists. Of course, he had nothing to do with it. But this is the frame-up. I just wrote a piece about it. It'll be in Veterans Today this evening. But these are three areas that you might want to discuss with him. Now, the Granite is really the key to the whole thing, because Mike Harari bluffed the U.S. government into blowing the two towers with the threat that there were 500 kiloton bombs up in the towers, just like the one that just hit the Pentagon. And amazingly, the day before the attack on September 10th, the famous defense magazine Jane's had published for the first time photographs of the Granite missile that has been top secret forever. But the day before the attack, miraculously, these photographs of the grenade appeared in Jane's. So Mike Harari arranged for this to bluff the Americans into blowing the building, saying, here's what's in the Pentagon, and these guys have two identical 500-kiloton devices up in those towers, and they're going to be atmospheric explosions unless you blow those buildings and get it down to ground level. And that's why they blew them, according to Dimitri. And Mike Harari bragged about this operation the next day in Bangkok at a celebratory breakfast. He invited Dimitri to come and celebrate this greatest thing he had ever done in his life, was 9/11. So these are the things that he you can talk about with him. These are the vital...
So he is
a witness. Now, there's another witness that's available today, if you want. Ray Ellen Rusbacher is available to speak also, because she found out that from the United Nations security chief that the United Nations building in New York also has a nuclear device in its sub-basement area, that way down below. And confirmed to her, two people at the United Nations confirmed that there's also the same plan in effect.
So this information would change the entire motive to what we currently understand for being the U.S. government's motive to implode those buildings on 9/11. I mean, how would this tie into the 1993 World Trade Center attack, where we know that John Antisef of the FBI had something to do with
it? Dimitri can tell you all about that. That was also a Mike Harari deal, as was Oklahoma City, and he can tell you all about these things. And the Marine Corps barracks in Beirut, 83, a mini-nuke. Now, there's no mini-nukes as far as Dimitri knows in the World Trade Center. These were real nukes. These were 150-kiloton thermonuclear devices. But mini-nukes have been used all around the world by the Israelis, mainly. And he can tell you all about that. So I recommend that you get with him as soon as possible on that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're planning to bring them up next, a segment for a wee panel discussion on this, JB. And you personally, I mean, you've got somewhat of a pretty awesome history there. Born in Chicago in 1946, Oak Brook, Illinois, then the polo capital of the world. Graduated from Carmel HS in California. Raced cars in Australia and England for 2 years, 3 years of college, mostly at the University of Nevada in Reno, and operated the School of Slide Control to train racing drivers and of others the technique of slide control. What is slide control?
Well, you know, if you go around a corner too fast and the car wants to go out of control, wants to slide off the road, then you have to control that slide. And I taught people how to do that, whether it was understeer or oversteer or whatever, and, you know, just the techniques of slide control.
Kind of like stunt driving and such like that, yeah?
Yeah, it's the basics that racing drivers have to have under their belts before they can, you know, be successful.
Should be a basic that every driver has to have under their belt, I would say. The theory of opposite lock,
Yeah. So in the British South Africa police in Rhodesia in the early 70s, and a section officer and support unit of the anti-terrorist group. Now, and you were also the first American in the BSAP since 1923. And you also started the modern militia movement in 1989 with your book, The New American Man, Call to Arms. The militia movement lasted until 95 with the state when the state-sponsored destruction of the Oklahoma City Federal Building. State Department considers you, quote, a mercenary. And the FBI considers you a problem, and the Secret Service considers you a terrorist. So you've got quite a mantle here, mate.
Oh, yeah. Real troublemaker.
Oh, yeah.
No question.
Just wondering why you're so busy telling the truth, man. I mean,
well, I've always been in the truth movement since about 1968. You know, one way or the other, I've been fighting these guys, and... I finally feel that we've got a handle on this now with Dimitri. Dimitri is the key to bringing down this horrible system that we're under, this war party. And we can show that, you know, everything evil in the past 10 years has come out of this 9/11. So Dimitri can show who was behind it, how it was done, and who benefits.
Yeah, yeah. And the 9/11 Truth Movement has been around for, basically since day dot, when the families indeed started this up. And many, many theories have been proposed. And, the difficulty is because there is so much evidence of cover-up, it makes it difficult to gather evidence of what was actually done. And this is one of the most difficult things about the 9/11 case is that often it is such a complex topic to discover because what I always say is that 9/11 has more red flags than the whole country of China does, even with their manufacturing abilities, you know. and the fact of the matter is there's so many facets to it. There's so many people tying in. There's so many different military stratagems tying in. There's Operation Northwoods. There is the thermite theories and all of this other stuff. And the fact of the matter is we have not had a real investigation of any kind in the official realms of the US government. My consideration is that when the government won't do their job, the citizens have to do it for them. And this is something that I believe Dimitri and various other researchers have devoted themselves to, not necessarily for the benefit of themselves, because there's virtually zero benefit in trying to expose 9/11 as an inside job, because you you just get demonized. And they do it generally just for the benefit of humanity, because they want to know the truth, or at least that's my assumption.
Well, Dimitri has kind of thrown a wrench in that.
Well, we'll continue this after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, our very special guest joining us on the line is JB Campbell from Veterans.
driving and I won't stop. And it feels so good to be alive and on top. My reach is global, my tower secure, my car.
Welcome
is
back.
My tower is pure.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Talking about, speaking of towers being secure, it's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, proudly brought to you by GorillaMedia.co.nz. We have connected up Dmitry Khalizov, coming at us live from Bangkok. Dmitry, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm here.
All right, excellent. Now, could you give us a little bit of a background about yourself and your experience with nuclear devices?
I was a military officer in the end of the 80s, a commissioned military officer, and I used to serve in the nuclear technical department of the Soviet Armed Forces. In particularly in its special department, which was responsible for the nuclear intelligence, like a detection of the nuclear explosions, nuclear tests, and so on. And I have a certain experience about the nuclear weapons due to my former service.
Now, the possibility of nuclear devices being used to bring down the World Trade Center complex, it sounds incredibly far out for those about hearing about it for the first time. What was the first thing that led you to this conclusion?
The first thing is that during my service in the so-called Soviet Special Control Service, which, as I told you, the just Soviet nuclear intelligence in the end of the 80s, I learned about the existence of so-called emergency nuclear demolition scheme of the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York. And it was well before 9/11, more than 10 years before 9/11. And I learned about this from a reliable source, because I learned it just from my superiors in the service. So as long as I knew that under the World Trade Center there were nuclear demolition devices, and when I saw that the way the World Trade Center collapsed on 9/11, and especially the fact that after this the place of the demolition was called Ground Zero, you know, the Ground Zero is a standard civil defense definition of a hypocenter of a nuclear explosion. It's mentioned in every dictionary. So that's led me to the conclusion that it was indeed demolished by the demolition devices, which were there anyway. It's logical to presume so.
Now, where exactly did all the materials go? And this is something that I wondered as well. How exactly do you comprise, what was it, a 400 meter tall building or something along those lines, down to a 10 meter tall pile of rubble, you know? Where did all that material go?
You see, the most of the material, the most of the structural steel, because the towers were mostly made from the steel. This was the main material in the construction. So, but when the nuclear explosion occurred deep underground, it created a crushing wave, which basically pulverized the most of the structural steel. So, and when the heavy tower top were falling down, they just scattered the dust, which was formerly steel, just everywhere around Manhattan. So the surviving pieces of steel were not so many, maybe just like 10 or not more than 10% of the entire tower body. So that's why the pile of the debris was very little. And the major part of the steel was reduced dust. And because dust was very fluffy, it just flew around. That's it. And you can actually see that in the videos.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've never seen clouds of dust like that before, apart from surface detonations of nuclear warheads done during tests in the American desert. Other than that, I've never seen anything kind of comparable to this kind of massive streaming plumes of particleized materials just flying all over the place.
Yeah, you see, if you read the contemporary description, you will see that the dust covered the entire lower Manhattan, and it was about knee deep, something like snow. during the winter. So means the most of the steel was just everywhere around Manhattan in the form of dust.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of a force would be capable of reducing that amount of steel into dust? Because how many tons of steel and concrete would was actually used in the World Trade Centers? I mean, we're talking thousands of tons, aren't we?
When it comes to the concrete, I would not exaggerate the importance of concrete, because the concrete was mostly used in the sub-basement structure of the tower only. But above the surface, very little concrete was used, because the concrete was only the relatively thin slabs of the concrete floors, which is negligible compared to the amount of the steel, because the tower, I mean the perimeter columns were made from steel, and the central core columns were made from steel. So, and the actual floors, besides the concrete, they were also made from steel. So the major material was steel, not the concrete. That is the important, because the pulverization of concrete can be more or less explained, but the steel is difficult to explain. Only the nuclear explosion can do that.
Okay. So if a nuclear device was used, I mean, you were specifically referencing that there were devices that were planted underneath the both World Trade Center 1 and 2, yes. And also conversely under the Sears Tower in Chicago. Could you explain those?
During my service in that Soviet Special Control Service, I learned it. I can surely tell you that I knew about the nuclear demolition devices under the Twin Towers. But when it comes to the Sears Tower, I can't confirm it, but I just heard about this, like, in the form of rumors only. But I can tell you another thing, that I got acquainted with one American journalist, Miss Raylan Allen, whose husband formerly worked in CIA, and who worked herself in the United Nations building. And she told me the same thing. She said that according to what she knew, that the United Nations building also has the nuclear demolition scheme. And she was even talking to the security officials of the building, and they were even offering her to show the actual nuclear device under it. I think if you can get this lady to our discussion, she can confirm this.
Oh, yeah, we're going to bring her on next segment. She's listening in as we speak right now. But speaking specifically to the World Trade Center, now there are three buildings that were demolished on the day of 9/11, World Trade Center 1 and 2 and Building 7. How is it that you're proposing that they actually pulled off these demolitions using nuclear devices?
You mean from the technical point of view?
Yeah.
Okay. The buildings, particularly the twin towers of the World Trade Center, they had an underground foundation. So the deepest underground floors of the twin towers was 27 meters below the Earth's surface. So the nuclear charges intended to demolish the tower were 150 kiloton thermonuclear devices, which were positioned 50 meters beneath the lowest underground floors of the Twin Towers. It means altogether 77 meters below the Earth's surface. So during the explosions of the nuclear devices, they will create the underground cavities around the hypocenter by evaporating the rock. So this cavity is supposed to consume the tower, actually, because the cavity will reach the foundations of the tower, and the tower is supposed to lose its base and just to be to immerse into the overheated cavity and melt there. I think that was actually the idea. But in reality, it didn't work that way, because besides the cavity, the pressure of evaporated gases will create the crushing layer of the rock around itself. Because when the rock inside the cavity, when the nuclear explosion evaporizes the rock, the rock will be transformed into the gas, understandably, yes? And this gas inside the cavity will be under very high pressure. And this pressure of the gases will try to expand the cavity to every direction. And in this process, it will crush the rock around itself, creating a crushed layer of the rock. So, and because the foundation of the tower when adjacent to the cavity, this crushing layer will also include the tower itself, the body of the tower. So that's why when the nuclear explosion occurred, it created a so-called crushing wave, which propagated by the tower body and pulverized the steel, the structural steel of the tower. But not completely. It was able to pulverize not the entire tower, but roughly 80 to 85% of it, as you can see in the available video. The very tops of the tower were not reached by the crushing wave, so they remained more or less undamaged and heavy. And under gravitational forces, they just fall down. And underneath of them, the almost 80 to 85% of the entire tower were pulverized. They reduced to microscopic dust. So those heavy tops of the tower were just falling down and scattering the dust. And that's what you can see.
Now, in terms of what you're saying here, I mean, kind of picture an egg, and the egg has several layers around it, kind of like an egg wearing a wetsuit, if you will. Now, the inside of it becomes sort of an evaporated rock area where it's just basically superheated gas, where the rock used to be following the explosion. And out around that, we have another layer of rock that is basically kind of containing the explosion as it is. But at the very, very top of this detonation, what you have there is the basement of the World Trade Center. Now, when the explosion happens and this vaporized superheated gas needs to escape, it'll go for the area of least resistance. So likelihood is it'll go more or less upwards, up through the tower. So we're in a combination of which, I mean, when nukes go off, they have these two sort of waves, one being the shock wave, which is just kind of like fast-moving air just kind of rushes past you, woof. And the second one is what's known as the crush wave. So we have superheated gas and a crush wave expanding upwards through the tower in such a fashion that it causes the entire tower to basically explode into particleized dust. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes, yes. But I would not say that the tower actually exploded to the dust. It's a little bit different. The tower was pulverized and by the crushing wave, dustified. It still looks like a tower, but in reality, it was no longer rigid structure. It was just like a pile of compressed dust. Okay, but because the nuclear explosion had limited power, it was not able to reach until the very top of the tower. So the top of the tower was just out of reach of this process, and it remained a heavy and solid piece. Okay? So understandably, under gravitational forces, it should press down, and under it, there was dustified structure. So then, and what it seems like explosion to you, it was not really explosion. It was just a mechanical process of the falling tower top that disintegrated dust to final dust. I mean, dustified structure to final dust.
Okay.
I would not call that explosion. It was more or less mechanical process.
So we're talking about the nuclear explosion kind of dislodged the tower itself, and then as because all of that the stability from the ground and everything was just kind of taken away. Everything just kind of happened in a natural process from there. It just kind of went zzz, woof.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Okay.
What do you think about the evidence of thermite that architects and engineers for 9/11 truth like Richard Gage have come up with?
I'm sure that these kind of folks, they are just the government-appointed shills who are intentionally disinforming the people, because the nuclear explosions in the middle of the populated city and the very dangerous amount of radiation release is extremely damaging for the reputation of the U.S. government. It's very scandalous. So those people who are spin doctors of the U.S. government, they apparently have to prepare some backup story to protect themselves from such a scandal. So all those people who promote the so-called thermite and the nanothermite theories, they are evident shields.
All right. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break with our special guest, Dmitry Kalazov. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, proudly brought to you by GorillaMedia.co.nz. Rumour Mill News has one interjection to make about all this. Take it away, love.
On the day of 9/11, there was a fireman who absolutely admitted it right on film, and somebody should be able to find that. He said, "We've got to pull it," and he was not talking about Building 7. He was talking about the World Trade Centers. He said, they are rigged with explosives, so they will fall down in their footprint, so we don't have a domino effect. And I mean, imagine if either World Trade 1 or 2 had fallen over instead of collapsing directly into its footprint. How many other people would have been killed that day? And how long would that domino effect continue? And so that was actually said on the day of 9/11, and I'm not the only person who heard that. But I did not hear that there was a nuclear bomb at the bottom of the World Trade Center, but I was told by numerous people that there was one at the United Nations.
Yeah, I mean, wow. I mean, Dimitri, to follow on what you said before the break about some of the other people saying it was thermite, and then you said, well, they're maybe shills covering up for the government. They're still saying it was an inside job, because if other explosives, non-nuclear explosives, were used, it was still the U.S. government blowing them up.
No, you see, the problem is that like this. The first of all is not maybe, I'm absolutely certain that those people who claim about the nanothermite and thermite, they are shills. That's no doubt. They are just planted bogus witnesses who are trying to protect the U.S. government with a strawman argumentation. This is clear.
But do you think it's still, wouldn't it still, to the average person out there who thinks it was Al-Qaeda and they flew planes into the buildings, wouldn't the explosive, the thermite argument still make the U.S. government look bad?
No, the point is like this. You see, when it comes to the nuclear demolition devices that were part of the construction, they leave U.S. government innocent, because they just use the pre-existing demolition device, okay, in the case of emergency. So it means that basically there is no malicious intention to do anything wrong. They just use the existing thing just to collapse the tower. But those people who claim about explosives and the so-called nanothermite, they imply that the U.S. government did something malicious. I mean, prepared the crime. You understand the difference? The nuclear demolition device is not a crime. It's just a part of the construction. But the nanothermite and the explosives, that is the crime. That is the premeditated murder. It's different.
Well, you know, and it is a very, very complicated case. And, you know, we've talked to Richard Gage when he was here in New Zealand. And, well, it's just funny, you know. We all think that 9/11 was an inside job, or at the very least, according to a recent article, 85% of Germans think that 9/11, the official story, was a bit of a fraud. So I think that the truth is really getting out there, that the official story, at the very least, wasn't the case, and we're still unwrapping what really happened on that day. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we'll be back the second hour of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio after the break. Thanks for listening. And welcome back to hour number two, the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, brought to you in proud collaboration with GorillaMedia.co.nz. We've had some comments that the internet streams are cutting in and out and we have no idea why. Sorry about that. Worst case scenario, you'll have to listen to the archives when they're posted later on in the week. Our very special guests join us, and it's quite a big discussion that we've got here today. Now, in this short segment, Dimitri, I'd like to, you to kind of wrap up this thing, because on 9/11, there were a couple of things that happened. There was Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the Pentagon, World Trade Center 1, 2, and 3. That's the five events. Can you tie those all together for us? Okay. Now, why exactly was the attack carried out on so many different targets?
Okay, I believe that the attack was carried basically only on the Pentagon alone. When it comes to the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, they were just... They had some explosives, not explosives to demolish the tower, don't get me wrong. The explosives to imitate the plane impacts, which is the different story. So some people rented the offices in the certain floor where the so-called planes should impact it. And they attached the special hollow-shaped charges of explosives in between the aluminum coating of the perimeter columns and the actual steel perimeter columns. And these hollow-shaped charges were directed inwards so that they will, when they blow up, they will create the hole that will remain, they will resemble the form of a plane. And then in the same time, they produce also the digital images, the falsified video that with the superimposed digital images of the planes allegedly approaching the towers. So they made that false footage of the planes, and they fed that to the different news agencies in the near real time, with maybe only 17 or 18 seconds delay from the real time. And it appears for the people on the TV that the planes impacted the buildings, but in reality they were simply explosions, because the aluminum plane apparently cannot penetrate steel, because the thickness of the perimeter columns of the World Trade Center was comparable with the front arm of front.
Well, hold on, we seem to have lost you there, Dimitri. Can you speak up, please? No, we seem to have lost him. Oh, wait, here we are. Dimitri, speak up again, please.
Yes. Okay.
Yes, there you go.
Where we were at the last point?
Aluminum planes going into steel buildings.
Oh, okay. So, you see, the many people, they don't suspect that the Twin Towers were actually steel. It looks for them that they were glass building, like a huge panes of the glass which the planes can easily break in. But it was not so in reality. In reality, the perimeter, the facades of the Twin Towers were made from the densely positioned steel perimeter columns, which were about 2.5 inches thick, which is comparable with the front armor of a tank. Okay? So the aluminum planes are just merely hollow tubes. They can't penetrate the steel thick as the tank armor. So they will just smash flat and fall away if it were in reality. So the people...
So it'd be kind of like flying an aluminium plane into the World Trade Center would be comparable to a bug flying into a windshield. It'd just go... And then it would, yeah. And then it would fall to the ground. I mean, yeah,
yes,
because they're incredibly weak. I mean, even at the very tips of wings on commercial aircraft, there's a little sign that says "Don't stand here," because you can actually bend the wings of commercial aircraft simply by standing on them. They're that weak. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, and we'll be right back after the break. broadcasting live from our drug money bought villa in the highlands of Italy. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, our very special guest, Dmitry Kalazov, joins us from Bangkok. Dmitry, welcome back. Now, we wanted to continue on talking about the penetrating capability of the planes. Now, those of you who are unaware of the construction of the World Trade Center, it is surrounded essentially by a caged shell of solid steel, all done with individual sections of trusses. Is a revolutionary design for its time, incredibly strong, and anybody who thinks that a aluminium plane can do a significant amount of damage to this, you'd probably be barking up the wrong tree.
Well, let me just speak for a minute here.
But that's just my opinion. I just wanted to preface as well. One of the other interesting things that I found about the hole that was made by the plane is that it's in the exact shape of the plane, like a Wile E. Coyote cartoon.
Let me just say something here too. I can make an argument and say a bird has the least dense bones of any animal on this planet. Okay, has amazing bone structure in its wings, in particular. A bird is very light, but if you were to hit a duck at a car at speed, I mean, I have. If you go 160 kilometers an hour, 100 miles an hour, I know that's breaking the government's regulation, but if you go 100 miles an hour and you hit a duck, you'll see how feathers can bend steel, and they'll go through your windscreen if you're not lucky. If you don't have a laminated windscreen, at 200 kilometers an hour, a bird can penetrate through a windscreen.
That's another important element to go on.
There's impact and impulse. When you have a plane with its wings laden with fuel, there's a huge amount of impulse when that contacts a static object.
The plane, we're talking about 700 kilometers an hour for a commercial airliner as well.
Faster than that, the speeds that they have a full throttle.
Okay, you see, I can address this. Intuitively it looks like this, but it's not true in reality. First of all, the commercial aircraft cannot fly at their full cruise speed at the altitude of only 300 meters above the ground. It's just technically impossible, okay? But what was shown to us in the video, that the commercial aircraft were flying at the full cruise speed. You understand this can't be true. The planes can fly at that speed and the altitude of like maybe 8 kilometers, but not 300 meters. This is the point.
Because the air density gets much greater, and at a lower speed, the planes don't have enough horsepower to actually push through the air that quickly, but they're still going really quick.
Okay. The second thing, when the planes actually were shown us in the TV penetrating the perimeter of the Twin Towers and disappearing inside, they didn't even decrease the speed. It just looked ridiculous. They should at least decrease the speed upon the penetration point. But they just continue to break into the tower at the full cruise speed. It just looked ridiculous. Okay? So that is clearly point to the digital manipulation. And the third point is that intuitively, yes, it looks like the fast-moving object can penetrate the object harder than itself, but it is not true in reality. In reality, I can give you in this sample. Let's say you have a plastic swatter to kill the flies, okay? And when you hit the fly with the swatter, you can, let's say you hit it in the 1 meter per second speed, you will just flatten the fly, yes? And if you increase the speed of the swatter, you hit the fly at 10 meters per second or 100 meters per second, the result will be the same. You will always flatten the fly. So you will never be able to achieve the speed that you hit the fly, and the fly will go clean through the swatter. It's not possible, okay? And it doesn't matter whether the fly, the swatter is moving, the fly is stationary, or the swatter is the stationary and the fly is moving, because the physics of process is the same. What is important is the relative speed. It doesn't matter what is moving and what is stationary.
It's relative speed, correct.
So can you imagine?
There's just other physical properties at work, though. Like to see another mock building made up, and an aircraft, not with people obviously in it, an aircraft flown by remote control, life-size into a building. I would like to see this whole thing simulated once again. I would like to see the exact conditions simulated as they tell the story as it happened.
So you remember that in, I think in the 50s in America, there was a case when the bomber accidentally hit the Empire State Building in the fog.
Correct.
I think it's quite known. So it didn't penetrate it. It just smashed flat and fall back to the sidewalks. It's well known.
Yeah, can you hear? There's a question over its speed. There's a question over how fast it was going. There's also a smaller...
It doesn't matter. Let's us imagine another example. Let's imagine that a certain giant take the Twin Towers, swung it violently and hit the stationary plane at the same speed. What it will happen? Will the plane go clean through the steel of the tower? No, it will be just smashed flat. And it doesn't matter whether the tower hits the plane or the plane hits the tower, because the relative speed is the same.
Now, let's talk about the you said digital manipulation. Now, people have been talking about this for a while, and supposedly it's been shown that all the broadcasts were enhanced. I was wondering if you could speak to that at all, because you're saying essentially, you said through digital manipulation, the planes were added in over an 18-second broadcast delay. Does that account? Does that account as well for all the amateur footage that was brought in as well of people filming from miles away, seeing a plane and all of that? Because they weren't mainstream media, they couldn't digitize those planes into thin air using their handy cams. So, what's your explanation for this?
You see, on YouTube, there is a very famous amateur video published by a couple. I can't remember their name, but it's famous. It was seen by many millions of people on YouTube. And it shows basically, it is the longest video. It goes more than 30 minutes or maybe 40 minutes. And it shows it started before the second hit of the plane, so-called plane, and it continues well through the tower's collapse. So, and in that video, because that's not official, it's the amateur, at the time of the second impact, you can clearly see there is no plane. It's just explosion. And the sky from where the plane is supposed to approach is clearly visible, and you can clearly see that there is no plane. So this video is probably the best proof that the old videos that show the plane, they are just the plane was superimposed. Okay, this is the first point. And the second point, let me just tell you one logical explanation, because many people didn't think about it. Do you know if some construction collapse, let's say that some bridge collapse and kill the people, do you know that the architect of the bridge will be put in jail?
No.
No, it's standard approach. When some structure collapses due to the engineering miscalculation, the architect will be arrested and put on trial. It's the standard approach everywhere. So if, let's say, that the designers of the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center were so reckless that they designed the tower in a way that it could, the plane can penetrate them so easily, and the kerosene can so easily melt the steel and collapse the tower, don't you think that the architects of the Twin Towers should be arrested and put on the trial?
Yeah, well, the architects testified that the towers were in fact built specifically to withstand airplane impacts, and said that in fact they specified that they were made to withstand multiple airplane impacts.
They said multiple 707 impacts. A 707 is a slightly lighter aircraft, a slightly faster aircraft, similar momentum. They also said it would take multiple attacks, and compared it to a pencil penetrating a mosquito screen.
You see, the 707, that was the largest commercial aircraft at the time, so that is comparable with the Boeing 747, actually, yes?
So the 757s that were used.
But the 767 is smaller than 707, apparently.
Yeah.
Okay, so how come that if the building was designed to withstand the multiple impacts of the 707s, how can it be so easily penetrated and collapsed by the single 767? It's just ridiculous. And even if it so happened, then the architects of the Twin Towers should have been arrested for the criminal negligence.
but also the head of North American Air Defense, whoever stood down the North American Air Defense and had them 135 miles away on the East Coast. I mean, there should have been some retribution there. You know, the military chain of command were flawed in their actions that day. There can be no doubt with the almost two-hour delay between the first impact and the Pentagon attack, and they didn't have any jets around the Pentagon. And that, no one gets arrested, no one loses their job. It's the same problem, isn't it? It's the same...
Well, this goes into the difficulty of actually trying to pin this down, because if it is a covert operation using sophisticated technology and manipulation of the media and things of that nature, it means that we're looking at a sort of a clandestine group involved here with high-level security clearance at the very least. Now, what the 9/11 Truth movement is sort of saying is that the US government was at least involved, but you're not saying that there was actual technical government involvement, but you say that there was key individuals operating inside the US government that attempted to pull off this heist, basically, or hoax. Okay.
I never say that the 9/11 is not a false flag attack. It is a false flag attack, but it was not penetrated by the U.S. government as a government. It was perpetrated by certain, organization, which is behind the curtains, not by the U.S. government.
I agree.
And those guys from the behind the curtains, apparently they have the agents... who work in the U.S. government, also in the U.S. military, who facilitated the work. Yes, this I agree. But I can't agree...
Who would you say this group is, the group behind the curtains?
The primary, that is those people who are promoting the globalization and the new so-called New World Order. So this is like a bankers families, like Rockefeller's family, the Freemasons, primarily the so-called Illuminatis. I mean those kind of folks.
The occult,
who are pushing the globalization. Super yeah, these societies. People, yes, they are the ones who did the 9/11, not the U.S. government.
Yeah, no, that's correct. And then that they control large sections of the U.S. government, the British government, our government down here. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It's a difficult thing.
It's just a difficult thing when we try and pin down exactly how they did it. And I mean, the mini nuke argument has been around for a long time, and the TV fakery argument, and all of it. I mean, I see it as a possibility. But I tend to think that if we need to get public concern, if we want the public to investigate, the public calls us crazy for just saying it was a controlled demolition. The public was even more crazy for saying there's nuclear weapons going on.
We are not crazy. I will explain to you why. First of all, I want to discard the argument about the so-called mini-nukes, because it's very wrong. The mini-nuke is a very small portable nuclear device which with explosive yield which does not exceed 1 kiloton. Okay? So the mini-nuke is just like, suitcase nuke. And the one which was used to demolish the World Trade Center was 150 kiloton hydrogen charge, which has nothing to do with the mini-nuke. The nuclear charges used to demolish the World Trade Center, they were about 8 times as big as the Hiroshima bomb, actually.
Can't they fit those bombs into the suitcases these days? Don't they have... I mean, mini-nukes have been around since the 70s, and there's a whole bunch of them that... were sold in the Eastern Bloc, but
you see, traditionally, when the people use the words mini nuke, that means they refer to the nuclear charge with explosive yield not over 1 kiloton, but the demolition devices under the Twin Towers were 150 kiloton each. Can you imagine the difference? So means we cannot use the mini nukes terminology because it just gives the wrong impression. The nuclear charges, I mean thermonuclear charges under the Twin Towers were so big that if you lift it up on the surface and detonate it on the surface, you will destroy the entire New York. It was just 8 times the Hiroshima bomb.
And so do we have any measurable radiological evidence
Definitely yes, because the civil defense specialist immediately undertook the radiation measurements once the tower collapsed, because it was ground zero after all. Can you imagine that? Okay, so but the problem is that because the U.S. government has power to classify these kind of things, they just classify that, they can't publish it.
I saw a few statistics about radioactive isotopes in the air at ground zero, and then a lot of people argued, well, that was just, you know, what was in the dust or in the construction or just in the ground. You know, you have small bits of cobalt-60 and a few isotopes.
Okay, I have the offer for this kind of people. Would they mind to open a pre-9/11 dictionary, I mean the dictionary printed before 9/11, and to check what ground zero actually means? They probably have no clue what is the meaning of ground zero.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, most people don't run off dictionary definitions. They just go off of social understanding, social definitions. But, you know, what else would you say was a clear, the definitive evidence that it had to be nuclear? There's no, like, it wasn't a combination of nuclear and then conventional bombs? Or
I would say all the leukemias that occurred from the first responders.
Yeah, yes, now that was another interesting point that you brought up when we were talking last night, Dimitri, is that one of the prime incidences of illness when it comes to radiation sickness, particularly was it alpha radiation, is leukemia.
Yes. You see, the most of the ground zero responders you know that many of them died actually in their young age from seemingly unexplainable reasons. So the U.S. government tried to, of course, to cover it up and to say that they died from the asbestos dust and some other ridiculous things like this, but it's clear that they are dying from the chronic radiation sickness. Because they were those ground zero responders who work in the ground zero, they were not issued hazmat suit and the gas masks. So mostly they were using the cheap respirators, which they didn't always put on. So they were freely inhaling the radioactive vapors, which were ascending from the underground cavities left by the nuclear explosions. And because they were inhaling those radioactive vapors, they inhaled a lot of radioactive alpha particles that remain inside their bodies and continue to irradiate them from inside the bodies. And eventually they developed the chronic radiation sickness,
classic chronic radiational sickness. If you're a first responder out there, we're very, very sorry to hear about that. And we'll be right back after the break on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Some incredible information being put out here. Back in a moment. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show you cannot hide from. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, broadcasting live from New Zealand, live from the future on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and, incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Now, one element we wanted to talk about here was the hot spot underneath the World Trade Center rubble. There's an article in here from NewScientist.com, Ground Zero's Fires Still Burning. That was submitted on the 3rd of December 2001. Indeed, a fire chief said that there were fires still burning underneath the World Trade Center rubble at a depth of at least 50 meters. And considering the bottom of the World Trade Center complex has a maximum depth of 27 meters, this seems very, very strange indeed. Dimitri, can you explain?
You see, the problem is that the World Trade Center was indeed 27 meters deep because it was standing on the bedrock, actually. Because, you know, it was very heavy. They can't just put it on soil, so they have to put it on the bedrock. And the bedrock in Manhattan was 27 meters deep. So the tower was basically standing on the granite bedrock. Okay, and the depths, I mean, as you rightly mentioned, the depths of the lowest underground floor was only 27 meters. So how come that the fires were burning 50 meters below the Earth's surface? What can be eaten into the granite and 50 meters deep? Of course, that was the underground nuclear explosion, as I explained to you, and this article confirms that. You can see another important detail in this article. Here they are talking about the two so-called powerful ultraviolet absorbers, which were mixed into the waters of firefighters to extinguish those so-called underground fires. You know that if you can read between the lines, and I guess many people are capable of reading between the lines, they will understand that these so-called ultraviolet absorbers, that they actually are radioactivity absorbers, because it's very clear.
So that's where all the heat is coming from. Now, essentially, let's see if we can break this down. So nuclear device goes off. It produces a, say, 100-meter-wide cavity, superheated, and it vaporizes the rock. That rock vapor pushes upwards, and then the tower essentially falls down into the cavity once the crush wave hits it, turns a lot of it into dust kind of thing, and then the rest of it sort of crumbles down into that big hole that was created by the nuclear detonation, and hence removing a lot of the rest of the structure from view. And as a result, the rock walls which are around there would remain basically superheated through the intensity of the nuclear explosion and would remain hot for quite some period of time because of it, right?
Yeah, because the underground nuclear explosion contains a lot of energy, and this energy will be spent on heating the surrounding materials. And you know that the actual cavity filled with those materials will resemble a giant pot, okay? So it will take some time to cool down. It, depending on the power of the nuclear explosion, this time will be quite long. Let's say for 100 kilotons, you can expect that to remain hot about a year.
Excuse me, Rumor Mill News, could you mute your microphone, please? We're kind of getting a dog in the background there. Sorry, Dimitri, continue, please.
because of the underground cavity filled with the hot materials, it means, can you imagine the 100 meters in diameter cauldron filled with the big volume of hot materials? It will retain its heat for some time, and this time is quite considerable. It can be a year, for example, for 150 kiloton explosion. In the World Trade Center, in reality, it retained heat about 6 months only, not a year. But that happened because the firefighters were continuously pouring the cold water into it to cool it. So they just increased the speed of cooling by artificial means. But if left naturally, I mean, it will cool down about a year only, not earlier than that.
Now, is there a precedent for this? I mean, where are you getting this kind of information from? I mean, and what you showed me a video the other night about a gas leaks, essentially natural gas leaks that were sealed up using nuclear devices, and similar types of phenomenon come out from operations like that, which was why, of course, because it's been done up to five times in the former Soviet Union to close up big gushing wells like that, that was why nuclear devices were suggested as a one solution to plugging the Gulf of Oil Kano mess.
Yes. So, you know, but in the Soviet Union, at that time, they use roughly about 40 kiloton only, the device to stop the gas leak. But in the World Trade Center, it was like 150 kiloton, slightly bigger, more than three times bigger, actually.
Now, some people would say, if there was a nuclear explosion that big, how come the whole of New York hasn't come down with radiation sickness and all of this? And the explanation is relatively simple. It's just the fact that the explosion was underground rather than overground, and most of the radiation was trapped underground with it. Now, the difficulty comes, Dmitry, when we talk about leaching, and this is something that happened in the Soviet Union as well, as you well know, that the radiation will eventually leach out through small little cavities in the soil and whatnot, and start to pour over the population. Is that true?
Yes, it's true. That's why the nuclear tests are not made in the populated areas. They are normally made in remote areas, free of the population. So, because when you detonate the nuclear charge underground, even in the sufficient depths, the radioactive gases will still, because they are still there and they are in the gaseous form, apparently they will try to escape to the surface through some crevices in the soil or in the rock or whatever. And eventually they will escape, and that will increase the radioactivity on the surface, I mean right above the nuclear spot, explosion spot. But normally, when it happens, when the nuclear explosion is well calculated, this process will be filtered, because when the radioactive gases go through the soil upwards, they will be filtered by the remaining soil layer, which is above them, which can serve as a natural filter.
So okay? Would there have been some sort of EMP, some sort of electromagnetic interference from the explosion?
Yes. You see, the problem is that the EMP results from the electrons flow. When the nuclear explosion happens, it will release the so-called primary radiation, which will travel instantly to every direction from the hypocenter of nuclear explosion. And this primary radiation contains X-rays, gamma rays, visible rays, neutrons, electrons, and other particles. So because of the electron component, and the flow of electron will create the current. Okay, so it will ionize the air around, and it will create the electromagnetic consequences. So this is the electromagnetic pulse. But when the nuclear explosion happens deep underground, the electron flow will be stopped by surrounding rock. So it will not cause visible EMP on the surface. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah. No, so just wondering about that. Okay. That makes sense.
Well, that's one element. I mean, now there's the other element is the different types of radiation that are released after nuclear explosion. Was it alpha, gamma, and beta radiations? And gamma can penetrate human skin, but alpha can't. You kind of either have to get them on your skin or inhale particles. But when you do, basically they'll sit in your body forever, and you'll basically never recover.
No. You see, when people is hit by the gamma radiation, normally it's the instantaneous process. It's like when the people is hit by the front of the penetrating ionizing radiation from the hypocenter of nuclear explosion. So in this case, then the gamma radiation can penetrate their body and damage their body. But from this one, unless the amount of radiation is lethal, the people can still recover without visible consequences later. But in the case of the underground nuclear explosion, the primary radiation was stopped by the rock, so it can't reach the surface and injure people. But
or at least not until enough time has passed, so the radiation will naturally start to filter its way upwards.
No, but in the World Trade Center case, there was no actually filter because the nuclear explosion was not so deep, and the cavity were practically open. They were just covered by the pile of the debris only, so the radiation can just go practically freely from the underground cavity through the debris pile and to the atmosphere. So everybody who was walking around there and on the debris and around the ground zero, they were actually freely inhaling radioactive vapors. But the point is like this. The U.S. government secretly monitored the gamma radiation levels. So they didn't allow people to get the overdose of the gamma radiation because they secretly... They issue everyone an individual dosimeter in disguise of the so-called air quality monitor, but in reality it was individual dosimeters. And they took care that every ground zero responders will not overdose, not get overdose by the gamma radiation. But the problem is that because they didn't issue them gas masks and the hazmat suits, the people were inhaling the radioactive vapors. And the radioactive vapors contains mostly alpha particles. And when you inhale, as you say, that when you inhale the alpha particle, it will continue to irradiate you from inside the body for extended period of times. And in 1 year or 2 years, the damage will become visible and the chronic radiation will become apparent. But that is chronic radiation sickness, not acute. And if people can recover from acute radiation sickness, but from chronic radiation sickness they cannot recover. It's forever.
Well, see, this is the implication that we have here is a general health crisis, and the first responders themselves have indeed been lobbying the government to pick up their medical bills and things of that nature, and the government completely ignores them and gives them nothing. You know, it's real, real sad and kind of heartless of anybody that's a part of the U.S. administration. The first responders, the heroes of the day, essentially, who put on their gear and went towards a burning, a towering inferno and just ran inside. Didn't with no concern for their own safety, just to save lives. And when it comes to them becoming sick, invalidated by the amount of poisons in the air, which the EPA said was safe, so they could get the stock market back open, of course, for some reason. then as soon as they come out and say, well, look, you know, we served the community, we tried to save people's lives, can you please help us? And they just go, no. This is part of the evil of the attacks that I feel is almost worse than the attacks themselves, as it's not only do you incinerate a whole bunch, thousands of people in order to perpetrate a false flag attack and a massive psyop on the population of the world to trigger a big bogus war on terror, which is basically just an excuse to steal everybody's rights away from them.
Yes,
but not only that, but you also just, you know, you just leave people out there to die, you know. It's like hanging people out to dry, and it's just sickening.
Yes, unfortunately. But you know what is the most disgusting is this. When the U.S. government actually demolished the Twin Towers by the built-in underground nuclear explosion devices, they did it with the goodwill. They had some reason, actually, to demolish the tower. Okay, but when they sent the gullible Ground Zero responders without hazmat suits to clean the place of a recent nuclear explosion, they have no excuse. That is the premeditated murder.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crossing the line, isn't it? That's crossing... Yeah, boundaries. And, I mean, this is a problem too. I mean, I have here with the some of the no-plane argument is at what point would they cross over from the digital imagery to the real imagery, because we can all agree that that building was standing in the morning and the three of them were collapsed in the afternoon. And so at what point did they go from digital to digital enhancement to the real actual footage? Where's the crossover?
You see, the first of all, I only express my humble opinion, okay? I'm not the expert of the digital cinematography. And I'm not one of those who perpetrated the 9/11, so I can only express my opinion.
I'm glad.
Okay, when I talk about the underground nuclear explosions and about the fact that I used to serve in the Soviet Special Control Service, and I learned this while in my service, I act in a capacity of an eyewitness. Okay, so this I know. But when it comes to the police,
we'll get into this just after the break. We're talking about no planes on World Trade Center Day 9/11. We'll be right back.
Vincent, can you hear me?
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back, Dimitri. I can hear you very, very well. Now, Rumour Mill News has one interjection to make about all this. Take it away, love.
Well, I wanted to say that the people, this is my opinion, the opinion of David Hawkins, the opinion of the Able Danger team, and you can go to Able Danger, which is A-B-E-L, danger.net, and that is that a very secretive American agency called the Senior Executive Service was behind this. This agency is so secretive that the media, the American media, never says anything about it. But a senior executive can go to any department in the United States, whether it's probably even the White House, but I'll use the Department of Defense. He could go to Donald Rumsfeld, who was in charge at that time, and say, I'm relieving you of your command. And he would take over the Department of Defense for that particular day or for however long he wanted to. Now, the Senior Executive Service really does not work for the United States government. They work against Americans. Their bosses are in what we call the City of London, which is the financial capital of the world. It's the financial capital. The Washington, D.C. is the military capital, and of course, the Vatican is the religious capital.
And they're all sovereign states.
And they are all sovereign states, absolutely. So anyway, in my opinion, and in the opinion of quite a number of other people, the Crown agents ordered the Senior Executive Service to carry this mission out, which means it was carried out by the Brits, but not the British people. The bankers,
the good old Brits, eh?
who are associated with the City of London. It was a financial attack on the United States. And look where we are now.
Well, the Brits aren't even allowed into the City of London. I mean, without permission.
No.
The City of London have a separate police force and everything.
Absolutely. Even the Queen can't get into the City of London unless she's got an invitation.
But the Queen's German anyway, so...
Well, that's true. That's true. Well, it's actually my relatives from Bavaria who are the Stuarts, and they're the real kings of England.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah, the William of Orange line. Yeah.
No, it's not the William of Orange.
Oh, the Stuarts. Sorry.
Stuart line.
I just wanted to interject something in here. Breaking news. New Zealand city of Christchurch hit by strong earthquake. This is from Reuters. 6.3 magnitude earthquake has hit Christchurch, and has we've had reports in that the cathedral has crumbled somewhat, and my sister and her husband and their little baby live down there, and they're all fine. So yeah, hopefully everybody will be good. But anyway, back to this. We need to kind of wrap this up for the audience themselves, because what we have here is an incredibly complex situation. We have nukes being used. We have the onflow effects of leukemia in the first responders. We have clandestine groups involved with this, deeply penetrating the U.S. government. And indeed, for some naughty reason, decide that they don't want the U.S. government or the U.S. people to be free or have any description of independence or economic security for that matter. And 9/11 as an event, I mean, if you just look at the cause and effect, what is the effect of the attacks? Global war on terror, huge amounts of defense spending, huge usurpation of people's rights, and basically it's kind of polarized the world, really, upon one false paradigm, which is the war on terror, versus the other true paradigm of actual true freedom, which seems to be just, I don't know, it's approaching the vanishing point, in my opinion.
You're right. America is toppling into a third world country. We have homelessness and poverty and people who are hungry most of the time. And of course, it's not being reported. You have to see it in the individual newspapers in the areas where you live. But we are in very bad shape. And what we are seeing is we're seeing a war in America between the unions and between the normal Joes who work. And these are the unions, the teachers' unions, and the government unions. And so the normal Joe works to pay for a government worker who makes 3 to 4 times as much as the normal Joe makes. And so there's getting to be a great deal of anger, and that anger is directed at the unions, who here in America are either owned by the mafia or owned by the communists. So what have we got?
Same here in New Zealand, don't worry.
Probably more commies and mafiosos, though. No, see, this is the thing I love about the New World Order, is at least we've all got the same enemies.
Isn't that the truth? All over the world, we've got the same enemies. Now, why in the world can't those union people see that they're being used by the enemies of everybody?
Because it's equality, equal suffrage, you see.
Yeah, equal suffrage, right.
Well, if I may point one thing out, we've been told the how. We've got two great witnesses, Dimitri and Ray Ellen, are willing to be witnesses to the nuclear devices, both in the World Trade Center and the United Nations building. But Dimitri is also a witness to the who, and that is a man named Mike Harari, who celebrated the attack the day afterward in Bangkok and invited Dimitri to a celebratory breakfast, and he can tell you about that, because this is the actual who did this horrible act on 9/11.
Okay,
Dimitri, you're going to have to be very quick, because we're coming up to the end of the show.
Okay, so the point is like this, that as I say, that those people who planned and conceived the 9/11, that those are guys from behind the curtain. But the practical executors were, of course, the Mossad and some other secret services agents. So, and one of them was the deputy chief of the Mossad, Mike Harari, whom I happen to know personally, because I was very friendly with him in the time of around 2001, 2002, and 2003. And this guy was actually very much interested in my knowledge about the inbuilt nuclear demolition scheme of the Twin Towers. Actually, he approached me for this reason initially, and then when we became very friendly, he revealed to me a lot of things, and practically he admitted that he was the one who did most of the job in regard to 9/11. And in the early morning, 12th of September 2001, in Bangkok time, I mean, he even invited me to the celebration.
We're going to have to cut you then.
Unfortunately, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening, and we'll post the archives up as soon as we can. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. See you later.